Thank you, Aunt. Jerry Jones, I'm an alcoholic. Been sober since January the 1st of 1973, for which I'm very grateful, and I'm very grateful to have the opportunity to share some of my sobriety with you the past three weeks. With a little luck, you won't have to listen to me next week. I don't know who's up next, but it'll be good. I want to talk to you tonight about the 10th, 11th, and 12th step of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hear some people say that these are the maintenance steps. And I don't quite subscribe to that. I think they are necessary to maintain sobriety, but I really think that these are the growth steps. This is the place in your program where, if you remember last week, we began to experience the promises. It says before we're halfway through with the effort of making amends and the steps that precede that, we're going to have some really pretty nice results in our life. And then it talks tonight about step 10. Says a couple of three things that I think are kind of interesting. It says that at this point we have entered the world of the Spirit. This is the point where we continue to take personal inventory and when we're wrong, promptly admit it. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. And we have not ceased, and we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. For by this time, sanity will have returned. We will see that our attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We're not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. That is the way all of our defects of character and all of our craving for alcohol and all the difficulties that we really have go away. When we apply the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, we're, as my friend Jim Williams says, we're working on something over here, and it happens over here. We just, the two don't necessarily seem to fit. Most people of the medical world, a lot of professionals, look at our simple bag of spiritual tools and say, this just really doesn't produce this result. Something else must do it. But there's so damn many of us that are having difficulty making that statement anymore. Because it does work. There is a connection. And the connection is that we have been given the ability, we've done our part toward making contact with a power that's greater than ourselves. And that power has done this thing for us. There are several things about the 10th step that you might as well know as now as later. Number one is that once you begin to experience the promises, you don't ride happily off in the sunset, never to be troubled by any damn thing in the world anymore. At least it hasn't been that way with me. Self-centeredness in many, many forms will return over and over again. I told you some of you the last couple of weeks that I'm a lawyer. For several years now, a couple of years, I've been working on a very major lawsuit. It's been a really good thing for me. It's been a good thing for my law firm. And I heard the other day that there was another similar lawsuit that had been filed in Fort Worth, and it occurred to me that it might be a wonderful thing for my firm to get a chance to work on that case, too. Pretty much like it. We had a lot of experience. So I was out of the office the other day, and I called back in, and I found out that we were going to be invited to be interviewed on that case. And I called the next day to check again and see, had the letter come? Had we heard from them yet? And then I found out the letter had come, but then a terrible thing had happened. They'd sent it to the wrong person. They'd sent the letter to one of my partners instead of to me. Well, you don't understand, what are my partners going to think when they find somebody else besides me has been asked? What will my client think? And it bugged me. Now, I was happy we got the opportunity, and I promise you it wouldn't make a nickel's difference to me financially one way or the other. I don't know how it would make a difference except in one area, and that's called self-esteem. How I think other people will look at me. And how do I know this is bothering me? Well, I woke up three times that night. And every time I woke up, I was madder than hell that they'd sent that letter to the wrong person. And the third time I woke up was about 4 o'clock in the morning. And I sat up on the edge of the bed a little while. I just wasn't getting much rest this night. And I said, you know, God, this thing either works or it doesn't. Now, if you let me go back to sleep, I'll get up and take that damned inventory in the morning. I'll do that inventory in the morning, the 10th step inventory. Continued to take inventory. So I got up and I wrote an inventory. By this time, you see, I wasn't only mad at the people that mailed the letter, I was mad at my partner for receiving it. He undoubtedly had schemed some way or other to get them to send that to him behind my back. So I was mad at him. I was mad at them. I was mad at my clients. I just was having a hell of a time. And all of it centered down to one thing, and it was self-esteem. Self-esteem. And I did what the book told me to do. I wrote about that. I came to appreciate what that was doing for me. And I already know what self-centeredness will do in my life. I've never had a good day being self-centered. A lot of days I've decided today I'm going to dedicate this day to me. I'm going to do just exactly what I want to do today. And by the end of the day, I'm sick or depressed or something wrong every time. It never fails. I can't get caught up in me and stay happy. And I know that. And I appreciated that. And I shared that fifth step with another person. And I got on with my life. Now, by the time I got to the office on Monday morning, I was able to walk into the partner who had received the thing and said, "I'm really glad you got that." And mean it. I said, "This is just what you've been needing." He's about 15 years or about 10 years my junior, I guess, and this is a good, wonderful opportunity for him. And he said, "Who do you think I ought to get to help me?" And so I got involved that day, and we put together a group of people, and then they went off and interviewed. And they blew the opposition away. There wasn't even a second place. We were called and hired before the interview process had been completed. And I sat there and watched those guys work that day, and I knew every one of them, I'd had a good deal of good part in giving my experience to them as a lawyer and as a human being and kind of helping train and mature them as lawyers. And I never felt any more grateful in my life. One of them said to me, "You kind of saw your props go to work today, didn't you?" And I did, and I got tears in my eyes talking to them about that. It's so sweet and so good when you don't fight it and you don't hang on. But you must be continually aware of what's going on in your mind. You must always know when there's a problem cropping up in your life. You got to know what's going on in your head all the time. You're not responsible for what comes into your mind, but you're damn sure responsible for what you leave there. And you've been given a program that tells us what to do with thoughts that come in our mind. We recognize the situation and see if we got any power over it. Well, I couldn't change where that letter went. I couldn't change who sent it or who received it or any damn thing about it. I could have fought to get in front of the parade and tried to look like it was my deal. But it didn't do that. And I know there's a solution. I know over and over that the real problem is always inside me, and there is a solution. The solution I've seen work in your life and in my life both. And it comes from turning that what I can't handle over to some power that's greater than myself and getting myself out of the way so that power can get involved in my life. Living up to my commitment to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. Having taken that inventory and looking at the self-centeredness that was cropping up there. Telling somebody about it. Being willing to make amends. See, I didn't have to make amends that time. I really hadn't had a chance to say anything or do anything to anybody. The only kind of amend I could make was to be gracious and tell people that I was happy for them and wish them well and try to help them on their way. And that kind of process will literally change your life. I think this step, the step always tells you to watch for self-centeredness, look for selfishness, dishonesty, and the other forms of self-centeredness. When you find them, quickly tell somebody about them and promptly admit any wrong that you've done and correct it right away. You don't always know the right thing to do. You don't always know when you're off base. You know, the day before this happened, I had no earthly idea that I would have this problem. I didn't feel self-centered the day before. But that probably had been creeping in to my personality again over some period of time. And you got to keep doing these inventories periodically on specific problems. I've done a lot of fourth steps. I call them four steps. You can call them tenth steps. But I've done a lot of inventories on my life, all areas of my life. And it's sort of like I was in the Navy. I was a navigator. And when you're lost at sea, don't know if any goose's idea where you are, just like I was when I got in Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not know where I was. I mean, in any kind of spiritual sense or what was wrong with my life. I just didn't have a clue. And so what you do is you make your best guess as to where you are, and then you try to decide where the hell you're going to try to go, and you head in that direction. Now, if you were 100% accurate about who you were and what you are when you finished your four-step inventory, and you started off to try to do God's will, I don't care how good you are. You're just like an old boy driving a boat. The wind and the tide and the current and the wave action will get you off course sooner or later. And the quicker you catch it, the closer it is to get back to the center line. And you just got to keep inventorying and keep looking all the time to see what's going on in my life. I have a problem. Every time I have a problem, I know that something's wrong with me. I got to check me out and find out what it is. I'm either reacting wrong to the situation, or I've caused the situation, or whatever it is. So I have to spend a lot of time looking at my life, recognizing what thoughts I'm having today. What's the committee talking about today? Do you have a committee? I have a committee. My committee meets at all times. Never know when it's going to call it, come into session. I just find them talking to each other without me really knowing what's going on. But they're going up, the thoughts are going on up there, the back and forth. And I have to be aware of that all the time. And when you're wrong, when you find you've made a mistake, promptly admit it. Do you realize how important that is? That's the damnedest thing you've ever seen in your life. I still have some trouble with self-centeredness, as I told you, and one of mine is the freeways. I own that lane of traffic that I told you all about, and it's my lane, and I ought to get to be able to do what I want to in my lane. And not too long ago, I started to go to work one morning, and I started to get on Central Expressway, and there was enough room. I mean, hell, it wasn't even real close, but I was in kind of a hurry, and I needed to get out in my lane right away. So I jumped in my lane, and I heard this little beep, beep, beep honking. I looked around behind me, and there was a little old Beetle Volkswagen back there behind me, and a little lady driving it, and she was giving me hand signals, and her mouth was just running about 200 miles an hour. She was shaking her fist. She was really angry with me. And we went on about a quarter of a mile, and my lane began to stop, and so I decided I had to change my lane again. I was just going to pull over one lane, and I noticed that she was too, and I don't know why I did this. The devil makes me do some things like that. I just pulled over in front of her again, and once again the horn went, the fist shook, the mouth was running, and then I got busy with my problems and forgot all about her until I got all the way downtown. And as I pulled over to a stoplight down on Live Oak, I saw her. I passed her. She had stopped in another lane there. And then I looked at kind of, don't know why, I just kind of noticed in my rear vision mirror, she pulled in right behind me. And she was just eyes fixed, just madder than hell. So I turned right, she turned right. I went down a couple blocks, turned left, she turned left. And I thought, you know, you may have a problem here. I turned right again, she turned right again, right behind me. So I just pulled over, curb and stopped, got out of my car. She pulled right in behind me and stopped. And I walked back and I said, can I help you? And she said, why did you abuse me and mistreat me on Central Expressway? You harassed me. And I had about 45 excuses I could have given her, you know, and a couple of cute remarks and everything. And I don't really know why I didn't do that, but that morning I said I was wrong to do that. I'm not sorry. I didn't say I was sorry. I just said I was wrong to do that. And you're exactly right. I did harass you, and I'm very sorry I didn't. And she looked at me and got kind of a little quizzical look on her face. She said, well, fine. And she took off, you know. When you promptly admit you're wrong, when you say it right then, before anybody else has done anything or told anybody, or it's the easiest way in the world to stop a mistake from perpetuating itself beyond the initial error. It's like playing catch with somebody, you know. When you make somebody mad, it's like they throw you a ball, and if you don't catch it, they'll get tired of playing catch with you in just a minute. And this little lady is a perfect example of how that works. Promptly admit it when you make a mistake. And say you're wrong. Recognize you're wrong. Saying I'm sorry may mean I'm not very, you know, I'm not the best person in the world. I'm kind of sorry. People describe that. And I've often said I'm sorry, but God, you're dumb as a post. In my mind, I say the last half of that. That kind of stuff. Just say you're wrong. Just say you're wrong and see what kind of results you get from that. It's really a good exercise. The 11th step in the program says that sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will and the power to carry that out. The two things in the world I didn't know anything about at all when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous was prayer and meditation. I didn't have any idea what meditation was. I remembered going to church, and they hand out those little bulletins when you go in, a sort of a program tells you what's going to happen. And right at the first thing, a lot of Sundays, they had meditation. And they had some little old funny saying up there, and they played the organ a lot while that was going on, and you talked about the football game that's going to take place that afternoon. You know, I never paid any attention to that at all. I had no conception of what meditation was. Prayer was something I had kind of a funny feeling about. I didn't like prayer. I did not like to be asked to pray. I did not even like to be in the presence of people who were praying. Now, if you said a prayer with a great big group like this, okay, we can handle that. Somebody can say the invocation or something like that, and if it's not too long and not too emotional, we can live with that. But my gosh, when the minister used to come visit my folks or something, and hell, it wouldn't be but three or four of us sitting there, and he'd say, "Let's pray." Oh, I'd get uncomfortable. Just get uncomfortable as I could be. Did not understand prayer at all. Lots of people don't understand prayer. I heard a preacher on television the other day talking about a little boy that was about 5 years old, 4 or 5 years old, just a little tyke, and he'd got into this idea of being religious. And that God was God is love. And somewhere he learned how to spell love, and the neighbors had painted the side of their house brand spanking clean, pretty white. And the kid took a spray can of blue paint and went over there and wrote love on it. And it created a lot of problems around the neighborhood there. His dad finally found out who did that, hauled him up and told him that, you know, he really got ragged with him, said, "You may have to work 30 years to pay this off, but you will pay this off. You will pay this off." So that night, little Johnny's going to bed, getting ready to say his prayers, and his folks just listening to see what he's going to say. And he said, "Well, God," he said, I know you're supposed to be loved, but it sure got me in a whole lot of trouble today." He said, I kind of wrote your name on that building over the next door, and they got real excited. Looks like I'm going to have to spend almost the rest of my life paying for getting that word love off of that building." Said, "I sure do wish you could help me do something about that." "I guess you will if you can. Amen." Went to sleep. And that night, a real big wind came up and blew all the siding off that side of the house. Now, nobody has ever been able to connect that little boy's prayer with the wind blowing the siding off that house. But when Johnny prays, they listen real good. My experience with prayer and meditation and the 10th step are all kind of mixed up together. And this will give me an opportunity to tell you the way I start my days and the way I've started my days for a lot of years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I needed something to remind me that I was an alcoholic and to practice the program of Alcoholics Anonymous every day. I don't know how many people I heard talk and tell how they meditated or how they did all sorts of things. And I'd say, "By God, I'm going to do that. I am going to do that. I'm going to do that every day the rest of my life." And then I'd remember it again about 2 weeks later. Wouldn't think of it another time. So what I need is something that I can do and can remember every day. And the first thing I got is a piece of non-conference approved literature. It's called One Day at a Time, the Day at a Time book. It's got a little meditation in it. It's got a little section about being an alcoholic in it. It's got a little prayer at the end of it. And I started using just that to start my day. As I got a little further into it, I began to read some books about meditation. I bought all kinds of books about meditation. I bought thick books, thin books. I bought every kind of thing you could read. Some of them were pretty spooky. And I couldn't understand what in the hell it was. Finally, one day, I was in the checkout line at a grocery store, and they have those little old 50-cent books stuck along there for people to pick up and read, I guess, and they had one on meditation, and that's what I got, and that's what I use. Here's my little book. My little book's real simple. My little book tells me the way you meditate. It gives you several different varieties of things you can try, but I took one that I thought was pretty simple, and I'd like to tell it to you. The way you meditate, it says, is to occupy your conscious mind on one thing, just one. It may be something you say over and over again, like a mantra, or like, be still and know that I am God, be still and know that I am God, over and over again. You may simply watch a candle. You may listen to music or to a metronome, the clicking of a metronome. But the idea is to keep your conscious mind occupied on one thing so it will slow down and back off from life a little bit. Get away from those problems that are hassling you all the time and allow you to get some distance and some peace and some serenity in your life. Now, of the kinds of meditation they offered me, I took counting your breath. I tried several, and I decided I'd try to count my breath. So the first thing I do when I sit down in the morning to do my morning meditation is I take my little book, the 24-hour day book, or a similar little book like that, and I'll read a little bit to remind me of what I'm trying to do today, which is I'm trying to change my life, and I'm trying to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand it, and practice these principles of my affairs, the basic program steps that I'm going to try doing. Read a little bit about that. Then I get quiet. I do this someplace where I won't be disturbed. You shouldn't be hassled about this. You've got a telephone, get away from it. Take 15 minutes and get quiet. Get away from everything. If you have to go in the bathroom and lock the door for 15 minutes, they can wait that long. And go in there and get quiet and sit down and do this. You get quiet, you sit down. You can't lay down if you wanted to. Close your eyes. Just get relaxed. Just relax your body every bit you can. Think about relaxing all parts of your body. Just kind of unlax and relax. And then you start to count your breath. When you breathe in, you count one. When you breathe out, you count two. When you breathe in, you count three. When you breathe out, you count four. Then you start over. That's not real complicated, is it? You would think most people, as smart as I am, could certainly do that, couldn't you, without thinking about another thing. I want to tell you what. I had no idea what a goofy mind I had until I started trying to do that. Like old Jim says, first thing I do after about 30 seconds, I start thinking about shacking up or something like that, you know. Doesn't seem real spiritual, but that's all right. You're not supposed to be able to control what comes into your mind. You just kick it out of your mind and go back to counting your breath. And you'll get to rock it along real good, and you'll count to four, one series, two series, three series. I'm doing real good, wasn't I? Because I'm not supposed to be thinking about how good I'm doing. So you go back and you start over again. Now what this is going to tell you, if it doesn't tell you anything else, is how your mind works. Most of us don't have any idea. And most of us, when we first start doing this, have got a mind that moves around a hell of a lot. I mean, we just change subjects and topics just like that. It's just like bullets ricocheting around inside of our mind. Oh, I've got to go here and do this today. And I have all these little things that I've got to do. I've got to make a telephone call. God, I better write that down. So I get me a pencil and paper and I set it right beside my chair where I'm meditating. And when I think of one of those things I just got to do, I just write one word to remind me of it and I go back to meditate. And over a period of time, you get to where you can slow your thoughts down, where you get still. And when I begin to get still, I oftentimes, before I get there, I will begin to recognize that I have certain thoughts, self-centered thoughts, like the letter was addressed to the wrong damn lawyer in my law firm. I'll think of that. And I know I am dealing with self-centeredness. The book tells me over and over that I'm not going to make contact with this power that's greater than myself if I am self-centered. I've got to get that set aside. So I have to make a deal with myself. I have to say, I'll make you that inventory. I'll write that inventory. But I've got to be free of this self-centeredness now because I need to make contact with this power. That's what I'm here for. And I go on through that process and I meditate for, I don't know how long I meditate. Sometimes it's 15 minutes, sometimes it's 5. It's whatever I feel comfortable doing. There's no magic to it. I do it a couple of times a day on good days. Sometimes I just do it once. But I almost always get to meditate one time during the day. The effect of that meditation is really remarkable on your life. It's after you get to where you do this for a while, you begin to notice things you haven't noticed for a while. It slows you down. it lets you back away from life just a little bit, to disentangle from it. And you walk outside and you look around and you begin to see trees and flowers and hear birds sing and little things, remembering what you're trying to do during the day. And it's not any, you know, I can't tell you exactly how you feel, but you become comfortable with yourself. And you get easy and you get calm. And we don't have much peace. We don't ever, I don't believe, make contact with this power when we're full of turmoil and scratching. It's when we surrender and when we accept and when we're at peace and kind of give up for a moment that we begin to experience the power. And when you reach that point, then I say my prayers. The book tells you some good things to pray for on page 89. My prayers are to pray for, I review the problems I've got in my life with this power. I confess my problems. I don't know a lot about prayer, but I do know one or two things. I believe you need to be absolutely honest while you're doing it. If you're ever going to be honest in your life, you know, you're not going to fool the power. You may as well try to really get honest and see what's going on with me, what's really bothering me in this situation. Why am I having trouble? What do I want? What do I need? And you pray for knowledge of this power and the power to carry it out, knowledge of the will of this power and the power to carry it out. We don't have to guess a lot about what God's will is for us, I don't think. It's to be honest, whatever you do. It's to be willing to help your fellow man. It's to give service, to try to carry the message to other people. That's what the power wants you to do. It don't care where you work. This power doesn't care whether you're president of a bank or a lawyer or pumping gas at a service station. It just doesn't make a damn, because you can be in touch with this power in any of those situations. All are useful. All are necessary things to do. And it doesn't much matter, I don't think, which job you take or which one you don't take. You may get some guidance about what you really want and where you're really comfortable by praying. But I don't think God causes some guy to have bad luck and get fired and another guy not. I think that's all part of the worldly thing that's going on here. I think we pray for spiritual things. The very first thing I ever prayed for was, I told you about how I tried to give this drinking problem to God. You know, and the way that prayer was answered is the way almost all of mine are. They didn't close the liquor store to keep me from drinking. They didn't lock me up anywhere. I had plenty of money. I could have bought a drink. I had opportunities. I just didn't have to drink. Or I wanted to drink, but I was able not to drink. And a few days and weeks and maybe a month, I remembered I drove home one day, and every day I'd notice the liquor stores when I'd pass them. I knew where they all were, and I'd think about what old Sam was doing in there and what George was doing in this one, and God, I really ought to stop, and all those crazy conversations were going on. One day, I just didn't have them anymore. One day, I got all the way home, and I thought, well, you didn't think about stopping at the liquor store today. As a matter of fact, you hadn't thought about that for some time now, had you? And it was gone. It was just gone one day, the way we talked about when we started this meeting about the drinking. It just went away. And a lot of the problems that I've prayed for in my life have been just that way. They just kind of go away one day. And I think that's the way prayer works for me. There's no gentleman named Keebler who lives up in St. Louis, Missouri. Paul Keebler. He's got 44 years of sobriety. He's from the Akron-Cleveland area. In the Akron-Cleveland area, they believe real strongly in the thing called the Four Absolutes. They're still mad at Bill for not putting the Four Absolutes in the Big Book. And they are that you should practice, and on the front of most of their podiums up there, you'll see them written, absolute love, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, and absolute, love, unselfishness, honesty. Honesty was the last one. And I was talking to Paul one night about this, and he wished Bill had put them in the book, and I said, well, they probably are a little strong for most alcoholics, you know, and you start talking about absolute purity to an alcoholic who's done damn near everything, that probably ain't going to set too well with him. He said, let me tell you, there's nobody ever supposed to do those things. You're not ever supposed to achieve perfection on those things, but he said, when you're trying to find God's will, they're real helpful. When you're trying to decide what you ought to do, A or B, then you've got some questions you can ask yourself. And he said, it's no big deal. Purity. Is it the right thing? Do I feel right about this? Honesty. Am I kidding myself? Am I lying to myself or to other people? Love. Is what I'm talking about a pretty thing? A beautiful thing, because love's always beautiful. And unselfishness. What will this do to the other guy? And if you flunk any one of those tests, go talk to your sponsor. That's all it amounts to. And that's kind of what it's like when you pray for God's will. We're not ever going to see way out there in the future. We're not going to know things. We're going to follow our nose the rest of our life. We're going to make lots of mistakes. But as we make mistakes and as we exercise judgment, we gain wisdom. We begin to learn some things. I can't tell, you know, I can't give you wisdom, and you can't give it to me. I can tell you what I've learned, but you have to grow your own wisdom. You have to make your own decisions. I know people who spend all their time checking everything they do with their sponsors. Now, for a while, that's really smart business. But after a while, you're supposed to be freestanding. You're supposed to be able to make your own decisions. And you've got to start making your decisions. You've got to start acting as an adult, a mature person. And you're going to make some mistakes. The way you get wisdom is to make a whole hell of a lot of mistakes. That's the way you do it. You make the mistakes and you recognize, I'm not ever going to do that again in my life. But that means you've thought about it. And then you do it again and you think, well, I'm not ever going to do that again and again. And finally you recognize, I'm dealing with some kind of selfishness or self-centeredness here, and I need to learn this lesson, and I need to do an inventory. And you grow and mature as a human being, and you grow and mature in this program. And this is where you practice learning about that. You pray for knowledge. Don't outline to God what it's going to be. Now, I make exceptions occasionally to that. Sometimes I tell God it wouldn't hurt if he did something, you know. But I never insist on it, maybe, because I don't even know what's good. I heard a story one time about an old Chinaman had a son, and the son was out in the wilds of China and captured a horse. Brought him back to the village, and he was the only guy in that village who had a horse. People came rushing around and said, God, this is wonderful. This is wonderful. The old man said, maybe good, maybe bad. The next day, the kid was trying to break the horse, and the horse kicked him, broke his leg. The only kid he's got. The only guy he's got to work in the field. People came around, and their chins were down, and they were saying, oh, that's too bad. And this is really bad. And the old man said, well, I don't know. Maybe good, maybe bad. The next day, the local warlord came through and was rounding up all the able-bodied young men to go off and fight a war. The kid couldn't go because he had a broken leg. People one more time said, you know, that's wonderful. And the old man says, it may be good, it may be bad. We don't really know what's good or bad. All we know is today. All we know is now. All we know is to act with good motives and for the best interest of God and our fellow man, and follow our nose and do the best we can with it. But this is the way I pray. This is what I outline, and this is what I look for. And sometimes I get a nudge one way or the other, and I follow the nudge. I follow the nudge. And I never know really whether I made a mistake or not, because I never can, you know, I can look back forever, but I really don't know what would happen if I'd chosen another route or if I'd made another decision. Sometimes I think I know, but I really don't. The book says that if you mix your meditation, here's what it says exactly. There's a direct linkage between self-examination, which is your 10th step, meditation and prayer. Taken separately, these practices can bring much relief and benefit. But when they are locked together and interwoven, the result is an unshakable foundation for life. Now and then, we may be granted a glimpse of that ultimate reality, which is God's kingdom. And we will be comforted and assured that our own destiny in that realm will be secure for so long as we try, however falteringly, to find and do the will of our Creator. That's what it's been like with me. When I mixed my 10th step and my prayer and my meditation, if I got 2 points for doing each one of those things, it's as though I got 10 points for doing them all together and interrelating them. It gives you a new way to see. It gives you new judgment. And it gives you an opportunity to experience the power you've been trying to find. You've got to become aware of the power. And this is the place where I've been aware of the power. 12th step says that having had a spiritual awakening, spiritual experience, as the result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. You know, this is where we started out. This is what the steps are about. As the result of these steps, we have had a spiritual awakening. We have awakened to what's really going on. Nothing spooky. That's what I thought in the beginning. Spiritual experience, spiritual awakening. I wanted to hear the music of the spheres and plants talk to me and all kinds of things. Walk on water, and, you know, it just never has happened to me. Never has happened to me. But if you look over at Appendix 2 of our book, it tells you what a spiritual awakening or a spiritual experience really is. And what it really is, and what we're really trying to accomplish, is a change of personality sufficient to allow us to live comfortably without drinking. That's what we're really after. And most of us, you can't change that personality of your own strength. You just don't have the ability to do it. Psychiatrists, all sorts of people have worked on changing the personality, and it hasn't worked. You've got to be involved, and you've got to have principles involved that you live to and act in response to. And when you put those principles to work in your life, and you're involved in the process, over a period of time, you have a change. And the change is to make you a different person than you ever were before. No better than you ever were, because it's just allowing you to realize your potential. You are perfect spiritually as you sit there in your chair at night. All you got to do to realize your spiritual perfection is get rid of some things that you're doing. You don't have to add a thing. And this is what happens to us in this step. We get rid of some of the things that are causing us trouble, and we start doing some things that cause us to change our motive for living and what we're trying to accomplish in life. It's a process. It's not a decision. It's a long-term deal. It says we tried to carry this message to the alcoholic. Our legacy is to those whom much is given, much is expected. What you get to keep what you give away. Do you realize that when the book Alcoholics Anonymous was written, there were fewer sober alcoholics than there were in this room tonight? 4 years had passed since Alcoholics Anonymous had gotten started. They had less than 100 members in the world who had gotten sober through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, from that day until this, millions of people have been touched by this program. Millions of people have gotten sober. Millions of people who have benefited in their families and their acquaintances. How has that happened? We have never had a big promotional effort. Nobody's ever spent a bunch of money putting this thing on television or in newspapers or on the radio or doing anything like that. We've never had paid people out trying to pass this message on to anybody else. It's come one drunk at a time, from one alcoholic to another. It's been communicated as experience one person has had, which he shares with another person. Now, we're trying to carry this message to the alcoholic. What's the message? What is the message? God has done for me what I cannot do for myself. And I have a way that I found this power. And I believe it will work for you, no matter what your race, color, or creed. If you got the honesty and willingness to try this thing, it will work for you. You don't have to believe it's going to work. You don't have to like it. Just do it, and it'll work for you. It will change your life. And that message has been communicated from one alcoholic to another all over the world. I don't know how many there are in AA today. We never did bother to keep count. We don't even have a real good way of estimating how many members there are in Alcoholics Anonymous today. But it's a big number. Those first 100 drunks, there's always been controversy in Alcoholics Anonymous. Initially, they didn't want some people to come because they were functional alcoholics. They wanted non-functional alcoholics. If you had a watch or a car or something like that, they'd just send you out and say, you're not through. When you're out of everything, show up here again. And so they were getting guys really off of Skid Row. Guys and gals later that were really at the bottom of the barrel. Badly damaged people. People who were near wet brains oftentimes. But they got well. And those near wet brains are the ones who wrote our book, who passed this experience on. As I look around this room tonight at the potential that exists in this room to spread the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's fantastic. But you know what potential is, means, doesn't it? It means it ain't happened yet. It ain't happened yet. And you've got to do your, you've got to work the steps. And then you've got to give it away. You need to do that to stay sober. You will not stay sober for very long unless you get caught up in the solution of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is to pass the message along to newcomers. That's why Bill went to see Eddie. I'm sorry. Did Bill go to see Eddie? I don't think so. Yeah. Funny deal. And some Eddie must have went to see somebody else. No. No, matter of fact, it didn't happen that way either. They had Eddie up ready to lock him up and put him in jail. And a couple of guys showed up, said, let us have him and work with him. We think we've got a solution for alcoholics. So Eddie got sober for a little while. Then Eddie called Bill. They hunted drunks is what they did. They hunted drunks everywhere. They used to drag them off bar stools in the early days and take them to meetings. Didn't work very well, but these guys were serious about hunting drunks. They weren't worried about screwing up drunks, because they knew the great reality is that you can't screw up a drunk. He's already screwed up. They didn't worry about how long they'd been sober, because nobody had been sober very long. They didn't have anybody that had a year of sobriety when they first started this thing going. They had to start with what they had, from where they were and who they were, and they began to do it in the simplest kind of way. You can read about it in our books. There's lots of good literature today on how it was done. And it was done because this became a very important thing in their life, this working with other people. They did it in the beginning to stay sober. But in just a little while, the joy of helping somebody else and seeing them get well became so much more important to them than staying sober for that day. And they just forgot about why they started out doing it. You get caught up, and there's all kinds of opportunities. Somebody just got here tonight. Somebody's been here for a while, and nobody's gone up and talked to them. You need to be, in this group, responsible for new people who get here. Go up and talk to them. Give them your name. Say hello. Get their telephone number. Ask them to call you, but know for damn sure they ain't going to call you. They're just not going to call you because they don't know how. They're too new to the thing, so you call them. Chase them. Find out if they're going to meetings. If you've got one day of sobriety, you've been sober one day, and you say you can do it for a day, let's see if we can do it for two. And you band together, and you begin to look after one another. And the interchange begins to happen. The magic begins to occur. When you get caught up in trying to help somebody else's life, you forget about your problems. And you work the steps, and you get comfortable with those things, you make some amends, and one day you look around and you're so much happier than you ever thought you'd be, you can't imagine it. And you share your experience. You don't ever try to tell somebody something you don't know. Just tell them what you've experienced. Send them to somebody else if they need to know somebody. Find them wherever they happen to be and get them in this meeting. Get them in here, because this is where the solution is. You're sitting right in the middle of the solution. It's the group of Alcoholics Anonymous where most of this takes place. Say hello to people. Take them to meetings. Encourage people to go to conferences that we have around. Get caught up in doing things with sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't try to hang on to your old life. Don't give it up necessarily if you don't want to. If it causes you to be tempted, and you know you're not banning those people forever, but for a little while you need to change playmates and playpens. You need to stay close to people who are trying to do the same thing that you're trying to do. And you're giving something away every time you do that. Speak when you're asked to speak. Talk and share your experience, your feelings in your meetings. That's a great gift, just to share the way you feel. It'll allow somebody else to feel somewhat similar, and you'll trigger something in them. You know, it's almost like we're a giant jigsaw puzzle. And every one of us is a little piece. There's a place for all of us. And if we're not in place, there's two or three other people that can't get in place either. You have to work a long way around to get to go around the missing piece. And you're going to, you know, there's people you can talk to and reach that I never would see. And if I got to talk to them, they'd come here listening to you than they would to me. I'm a gray-haired old summit, you see. And you all are young. And you've got a lot of good things going for you. One of the good things you got for you, you haven't been sober very long. When I came to AA, they started showing me people like this bunch of old birds back over here that, you know, they talked about being sober 10, 15, 20 years, stuff like that. I figured, hell, anybody been sober that long couldn't have much of a problem. It's so dry, they were fire hazards, you know. And I wanted some new ones. I wanted some people that had just been sober a little while. And I ran across this guy named David who had 6 months. 6 months. By God, I could almost think about 6 months sober. I'd been sober about a month. And this held some promise. And I began to ask him what he did. And that's what's happening here. People with less sobriety than you are, when you've got 3 months or 6 months, they're watching you. You become somebody they're watching. They're listening. They're just like you were. They're scoping this place out. But it's important that we carry this message. There are jillions of alcoholics out there. We're making them faster than you can shake a stick at them. And they're never going to find us. They're never going to find this solution except for you and I. Treatment centers are wonderful things. But don't get treatment centers messed up with recovery, because treatment centers are for treatment. Alcoholics Anonymous is for recovery. No treatment center that's worth its salt ever tells anybody to do anything except go to Alcoholics Anonymous when they get out of treatment. You've got to be involved in that. And it's a wonderful place to go and find drunks. I'm glad they can bunch them up for us. It's a lot easier than finding them in bars. Don't fight them. Don't fight them. Help them. Help them get them out of there into Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome them. Make them a part of your group. Get involved in your group. That's another very important thing. You know, you owe this place your life. So support it with your money. Keep it clean. Be conscious of what's going on here. Be responsible for what's happening here. Be on the programs. Go to business meetings. If you haven't been to an AA business meeting, you really have missed a really interesting experience. You cannot believe how we're so full of love and harmony and have the damnedest fight you ever heard over coffee. You know, coffee and literature and all those wonderful things, we just knock down drag outs on that kind of thing. But carry the message. Take a chance. Take a chance. I've never been on a 12-step call one time in my life, no matter what time of the day it occurred, and they seldom occur at the right time. They're always occurring at very late in the night or when it's not a good idea. But I've never been on one of those things. I've never talked to a new drunk that when I left the presence of that person, I didn't feel like I had been in exactly the right place doing exactly the right thing while I was talking to him, whether I knew what to say or not. And there's a whole chapter in our book written on what to say, how to talk to the newcomer. So take a chance. Go for it. Go for it. You haven't got a damn thing to lose, and you're going to find that it gives you a purpose in life that you never... anybody here ever wonder why you were born and why you're living in this damn dirt ball called Earth? I spent a lot of time worrying about that. Since I got into the solution of Alcoholics Anonymous, I know my purpose in life. My purpose in life is to work with alcoholics. That's my job. I'm good at that. There are doctors and preachers and all kinds of people who pay a lot of money to have the kind of knowledge and experience that I was given. Well, I kind of earned it the hard way. But your experience becomes your greatest asset. The moment you accept it, presto, all that dark past suddenly becomes really good stuff for you. Just practice these principles in all your affairs. If there's one thing that you and I never need to be again, it's two people to two different groups. We need to be the same person all day, every day, with whoever we're dealing with. Now, I hear people say from time to time, I couldn't practice honesty in my job. If you got that kind of job, try it. If they fire you, you're well off. And it'll probably surprise you how well it'll work if you practice it. I'm a lawyer. Damn few people have got much confidence in the honesty of lawyers. But I can promise you I haven't had any trouble being honest in my profession. It's worked for me. It works for me every time I'll let it work. And you're always tempted to do something dishonest. We all are. To take the shortcut. To try to take the easier, softer way. But that always turns out to be the hard way. It works in every area of my life. It works in every area of everybody's life. The principles of this program have worked in my family. I had a heck of a time at home. You know, I could be a real good AA up here and go home and just raise unshirted hell with my family. Because nobody could see me there. They had to take me the way I was, you see. And this, you know, I couldn't take a chance with my wife. You know, I had to keep her in line, or I thought I was keeping her in line. And I had those kids that I was having to hassle and work with that I talked about last week. But over a period of time, I started trying to take this program home to my family, to practice the honesty and the tolerance and to be honest, to be who I am with them, to be a person who's not perfect, who makes a lot of mistakes, doesn't know the answer to every question that comes up, willing to admit I've made some mistakes in my life. And over a considerable period of time, that's really been useful to me. There's a principle called anonymity. That's why we don't use last names here. Well, we should use last names here. My opinion is, how in the hell are you going to find Jerry J. in the telephone book? If you need to find me, I ought to let you know who in the hell I am. Now, outside is where I've got no business telling anybody your last name. In the radio and the television and press, things like that, that's where you don't use your last name. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we use our last names. People got to know each other here. And when you get comfortable, you need for the people at your place of work to know that you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd been sober for 11 months when I finally got nerve enough to tell the people where I worked that I was an alcoholic and that I was trying to do something with my life. And I wouldn't have told them except I was scared to death they were going to find out anyway. There was this lady that I went to AA with who decided to take me around and have me talk. And she knew a lot of people, and she hauled me all over Dallas. And I'd walk in a room, and I'd just scope the place out trying to see who was here that was not supposed to know I was in AA, you know. Just cold sweat popping out all over me, you know, and I'd talk, and I'd escape one more time. And I figured sooner or later, hell, there's 180 lawyers in my law firm. Somebody's going to know something one of these days, and they're going to find out about me. And it occurred to me about 11 months, they probably already know. They probably already know. They're waiting until you're in partnership meeting to kick me out of the firm. They're going to get me in there and embarrass me in front of everybody else. I'm damned if I go to a partnership meeting and let that happen to me. I'll go tell them. That's what I'll do. I'll tell them. So I picked out five. And I picked out the meanest one that I thought was the meanest one first. And I went in to see him. He was the managing partner. He immediately reacted to everything you said. Just immediate. And it was always strong. And I walked in and I said, Mr. Rutland, I said, I need to tell you something. He said, all right, sit down. I sat down. He said, what do you need to say? I said, well, I need to say to you that I'm an alcoholic, that I've been sober for 11 months, and I've been going to Alcoholics Anonymous regularly since that time. And I'm not telling you this because it's good or bad. I'm just telling you this because if you see me drinking, some of our clients are in trouble. And if you ever know anybody that needs any help with alcoholism, I think I know a way to help. And I stopped. And he said, I am delighted. He said, we've been knowing that something was wrong with you for a long time. And he said, we've been knowing you've been getting better for quite a while now. He said, you may have noticed we started sending you a lot more business. And he said, hell, when you tell me you're an alcoholic, that's something people with your problem generally not ever able to say to anybody. And when you tell me you've been an Alcoholics Anonymous, he said, my God, that's exactly where you're supposed to be when you got this problem. He said, that's a fine organization. He said, I've read a lot about that thing. It's good. And he sat there for about 30 minutes and told me what a bright future I had with that law firm. And when I walked out of there, I could have whipped King Kong left-handed. I knew no fear. I went and told those other four guys, I didn't give a damn what they said. Because the main man had already blessed me. But guess what? One of them didn't want to talk to me about it. He ducked. He wanted to talk about his farm. He wanted to talk about football. He wanted to talk about damn near anything. And finally I said, wait a minute. I got to tell you this. This is a part of what I'm doing. And he said, oh, I know. He said, I'm an alcoholic. About 2 years later, I got to take him to his first AA meeting. That would never have happened if I hadn't gone to see him that day. Now, since that time, I've got to help and be part of the recovery of secretaries and lawyers and, you know, just all kinds of people in my life. Judges know about me, and nobody that doesn't know about me if they want to know about it, because just I haven't got any anonymity anymore. And guess what? What are they going to do to me? What are they going to do to me if they find out I'm an alcoholic? Not a damn thing. It's only when I don't think they know that they got some power over me. When I tell them I am and I'm comfortable with it, they can't do anything to me. If I've ever been hurt in one way for being a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know it. I don't know what the hell I'd had time to do, because life has been so good to me since I got in this program. I have more friends than you've ever seen. It's just incredible the number of people across the state of Texas in this nation that I can pick up the phone and call, and they're glad to hear from me. And when they call me, I'm glad to hear from them. I've got a whole network of people that have come to me in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. One of my partners is a real hustler. He's the best business getter we got. And he's always running across people that ask how Jerry Jones is doing. And they all, most of them got little bloody, little red noses, you know, and look like they've been run hard and put up wet a few times. And he's got to where he can recognize sober drunks. And he's telling me the other day, he said, "Guys, you got the damnest bunch of people around this state that know you I ever saw." He said, "Ain't that wonderful? Ain't that wonderful?" And I've got to be a part of a lot of people's lives, like you. I've got to share my life with you, and I really hope that as time goes along, I'll get to share my life with some of you. I've had a couple of young fellows here said they'd like to share theirs with me some, and I'm happy about that. I want to thank you for listening to me. I want to tell you with every fiber of my being, with all the earnestness that I can command, that if you give this thing a real good shot, it'll work for you. It'll take you places you never even dreamed of. If you had a list of what you'd settle for today, you'd settle way short. You'd settle way short. Because the power works. The power is here. And when you're going the same direction as the power is going, it's an easy, comfortable life. When you get off the track, and you will, there's an easy way to get back on again. If you stay active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you practice these principles in all your affairs, whatever they happen to be, and if you keep on trudging the road of happy destiny. And what trudging means, I always thought that sounded kind of heavy. Trudging means to make persistent, slight progress. Just move along a little bit at a time. And I look forward to seeing you again sometime. Thank you.